Welcome to Passing Years CAM Podcast, Conversations on Aerodigestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Laura Morgan, having a conversation about her experience as a clinician who has been on both sides of the table from a speech-language pathologist's perspective.
Today, we're sitting here with Laura Morgan, and very excited to talk with you today, Laura. I would like to share with the audience, I knew Laura back when she was in our graduate program at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center, located in Knoxville, Tennessee, and she was a student in the speech-language pathology program there for her master's and completed her master's and then went into the field of speech pathology as a clinical fellow, doing that initial practice. But Laura's going to share with us kind of what she calls both sides of the table, her perspective on speech pathology, because she had a life-changing event that really shared or provides a different perspective. So Laura, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you maybe introduce yourself a little and start your story.
Sure. Thank you, Dr. King. I am Laura Morgan, a speech pathologist, brain injury specialist. I have a unique perspective as also being a survivor of a moderate severe diffuse axonal traumatic brain injury. I am speech pathologist of head injury rehabilitation and referral services. It's in Rockville, Maryland. I bring to the table all of my tried and true compensatory strategies, as well as the factors that I think motivate or discourage clients individually. I'm passionate about compensatory strategies and the role that the individual has in their own recovery. I think the importance of cultivating and encouraging an atmosphere of hope cannot be minimized. And I'm happy to share some of my story. It is a story of adjusting to being a recipient of the same form of therapy I'd been trained to provide. So in spring 2012, which was just weeks before finishing my master's at University of Tennessee under Dr. King, a close friend from grad school, Kelly Turzin, and I spontaneously decided to do an open mic competition in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I'm just including this story because it relates in an interesting way. That night, we performed a beautiful reflective song that Kelly had written about a friend who had died in a car accident. And once we were there for the open mic night, we thought it was just casual open mic. We found out it was a competition. We didn't realize that beforehand, but we said, what the heck, we'll go through. And even more spontaneous is the fact that we won playing a song about a friend who got in a car accident. And interesting, also a life factor, is that I had just completed my third half marathon shortly before the accident, and I was training for my first Tough Mudder. So I went into the accident coincidentally in probably the best shape, physical shape of my life. I'm grateful for the cardiovascular impacts of that fact. Back home to Maryland, I accepted a clinical fellowship position in a long-term care and rehab facility where I quickly met and became really close friends with my coworker, Anna, and her name will come up again later. But I'd completed about 4.5 months of the 9-month CF. So it was exactly halfway through when my grandmother died. And this was shortly before the Christmas holiday, and we were just all exhausted from that time of year and my grandmother being sick and then passing away. But we had to get there. We loaded up the van and said a prayer, of course, buckled our seatbelts, and we're off. And in about, we were about in the Lynchburg, Virginia area when our van drifted off the road. And normally you would hit the rumble strips on the side of the highway right there, but parked right there was an 18-wheeler semi truck. So that's what we hit. And of course we had our seatbelts on, but it ended up interestingly. Also at the exact time of the accident, a car with two off-duty nurses was traveling in the opposite direction on the highway. So personally, I give credit to a higher power for that incredible coincidence that I have little doubt saved my life. The nurses saw the accident occur. They pulled over, ran across the median, called 911, and held my head in the medial position so I could breathe. And being nurses with their training, they could probably tell that my neck was broken, which it was. And, you know, any well-intentioned stranger easily could have killed or left me paralyzed. But the nurses knew what to do and they called 911. And fasting forward a little bit, initially I was given a Glasgow coma score of 3, which is the lowest possible score. Later, we learned that I'd sustained a moderate to severe diffuse axonal traumatic brain injury. I'd broken my jaw, broken several ribs from the seatbelt, and had complete fractures of spinal vertebrae C1 and C2, the atlas and axis, highest in your column. And several additional incomplete fractures of spinal vertebrae. I was taken by ambulance to Lynchburg General Hospital, which was in the nearest nearby, where I was stabilized and then flown by helicopter to the University of Virginia Medical Center, which was a bigger hospital equipped to manage my severe injuries. Shall I go into keep going, or is there anything that you want to cover more?
No, that's good. I was not going to interrupt the flow because I know sometimes going through the story and trying to get all of the pieces together can be difficult. But I do want to share, you mentioned the Glasgow Coma Scale score, and that's a typical scale used when people have been in an accident that ranges from 3 to 15, 3 being basically unresponsive in any way. And they look at verbal response, eye opening, and movement. And so for you to have had a Glasgow Coma scale score of 3, you were basically completely unresponsive. I did not know. And so I just learned, I didn't realize you had the amount of spinal injury in the accident that you did. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure as you share your story, you'll share a little bit more about just the recovery and what all of the injuries actually led to. But I don't have any direct questions, but I do appreciate the story.
Yeah, sure. So given the gravity of my injuries, my family was warned that I might be paralyzed, ventilator dependent, and cognitively unable to hold a job for the rest of my life. Statistics are what they are. I'm passionate also about saying there should always be left room for hope, especially when dealing with the insane, crazy organ of the brain. The brain is just amazing, and what neuroplasticity may take place. Yeah, but I'm sorry, I digress. Thankfully, fairly quickly, I was weaned from the ventilator and progressed from being tube fed to a regular diet I have the scar from the, I can see where the peg tube was, and also have the trach scar. And apparently I'm told that after a month or so in the hospitals, I could see the screen as the speech pathologists were reviewing a swallow study that had been performed on me. And my dysphagia knowledge must have gone on autopilot because apparently I was accurately interpreting what I saw on the screen out loud. But yeah, that brings me to an interesting point. At some point, I was talking with a rehab therapist, and fortunately for this story's preservation, my mom and sister were present, and apparently the therapist asked me if I have any pets at home. In reality, my family had a dog and a cat at that time, but I replied, oh yeah, I've got lots of animals, dogs, cats, baby lambs, and this is a good part, I'm a big time duck feeder. Like, of all the cool occupations to dream up and brag about, that I literally could have said anything. And I came up with feeding ducks. I don't know. Yeah, pretty lofty subconscious ambitions.
I like that though. And it links to what you said about the brain,
yeah,
and the magic of the organ of the brain, and it just what it does and does not do. Mm-hmm. The fact that you would have gone to that type of background and animals, it's kind of fun. But
yeah, sometimes there are bits of truth in confabulations. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just the brain doing its best to make sense of an insane situation. Where I'd like to point out that feeding ducks is kind of crazy, but my reality at that time was definitely crazy. I'd gone from an athlete, a clinician, many other things, and a musician, and all of a sudden my reality was so unbelievable. It was so different from anything I'd ever experienced. So yeah, don't ever assume a patient's crazy story is indicative of them being crazy. There might be bits of truth in there, but I think all it really is pointing to is a brain working overload to make sense of a crazy situation.
Well, I've often thought of it too as, I've heard people describe how our brain is organized as being sort of like a filing cabinet,
yep,
with multiple drawers and multiple folders and information within those. And when someone has had a brain injury, that information gets kind of mixed up. The folders have been kind of spilled out of the drawers and they've got to be put back is kind of how I look at it sometimes. And like you said, sometimes within the confabulation, which is, we think of confabulation as a patient making up information, confabulating, making up a story to fill in the blanks. But there may be, like you said, truths within the confabulation or something that's linked. Could be a childhood memory. It could be an interest that someone had at one point. Could be a dream that they are remembering and bringing in. But there certainly could be that mixed up, getting those mixed up folders back into place could certainly be also linked to just trying to get all the memories. And like you said, making sense of the current reality,
yeah,
in the way of trying to do that.
Absolutely. And exactly, that is the file cabinet comparison is the one I've heard most often in referring to confabulations. And I think it makes the most sense too, because some of them are crazy, like being a duck feeder, but some are just your brain trying to grasp at anything to make sense of a crazy circumstance. And summarizing my inpatient days is a little difficult. because I have absolutely no memories of any of the 72 days that I was inpatient. That's kind of remarkable to me. I'll think, surely I'll remember something, but no. And I wasn't medically induced coma for that whole time. That was only a tiny fraction of the time. And then I was interactive with people. So yeah, it's interesting to me.
Laura, you mentioned having a tracheostomy and being on the ventilator. Do you know how long you were on a ventilator or had a tracheostomy?
I don't. And I certainly don't remember any of that. Mm-hmm. I know I've heard from my family that they were glad for everyone involved, including myself, once the speaking valve was put on, because for some reason, I seemed clueless to the fact that no one could hear me. My mouth was moving a lot, but I wasn't making any sound, of course. And so they were happy for me when I was able to make sound.
I'll let you continue your story. You said 72 days in
Three different hospitals. The last hospital was where I also started my outpatient therapy. My first phase was at-home therapies, where a PT and OT would come to my house, and I think, yeah, also a speech. Speaking of speech therapy, just FYI, I know I must have had swallow therapy early on, but apparently that was not for long. I was able to transition to oral feedings very quickly. And from that point on, speech therapy was all cognitive. Therapies, executive function is the big one, but I can touch more on that later. I noted throughout my recovery that as my cognitive abilities improved, I would also notice new levels of grief that I was experiencing. And I thought about that a lot, and I started referring to this as a double-edged sword of cognitive progress. Because, yeah, the more I improved cognitively, the more I could recognize what I'd lost and what my reality was. It was probably happier being a duck feeder. Maybe not as good therapeutically, but that would have been a nicer reality. So having been on both sides of the speech pathology table, I recognize some of the challenges that this discipline is up against in the process of rehabilitation after brain injury, as well as some motivating clinical resources that we can tap into. One thing I observed is that goals of therapies like those in physical therapy, for example, more easily lend themselves to determination, since you can see the results of your hard work or see the need for modification or a new source of motivation. I personally experienced many times how if a task was cognitive in nature and I got something wrong, I had to try again with use of the problem solving or other strategies being addressed. I couldn't just tell my brain to simply work harder like I could if I needed to walk more efficiently or lift a weight. Then you can say, okay, I see what I need to do. I'm going to add some more determination I'm a very determined person, so I am wired that way. But the cognitive tests of speech therapy were really challenging and discouraging, because if your brain wasn't working, you had to identify what do you need to do differently, which is difficult if the organ that you're trying to use to solve that problem is the one that is broken. So in my experience, cognitive challenges could be like banging my head against a wall over and over and over. It was very frustrating.
One thing I thought about you as I followed your progress, when you first started posting, you shared some poetry and songs, you know, so there was a little bit of information. You shared things that you had written about your story. But one thing I picked up on all of it was you have a lot of resilience and self-motivation, like, and it kind of fits in with what you're saying about the cognitive piece being so hard. If you had not had the internal strength that you have, mm-hmm. I don't know that you would have progressed as far as you did, because you're very resilient, and you certainly, you've had to work hard.
Yeah, I'm grateful that I'm wired as a person that it was a blessing and a curse at times during the rehab, ultimately a blessing, but I could pull out right now. Sometimes I've shown during presentations this massive to-do list, checklist of all of the activities and exercises that I was being assigned in PT, OT, speech, neurocog, all these different, and that's just talking about the therapies. I also had goals for my personal development of getting back to a social life, I used to be a leader in certain areas, like within my church and those areas, and art. Those things were all very important to me. So I made this huge to-do list that I would try to check off as many things as I could every single day. That fueled the rate of my recovery, I'm sure. Being who I am, I would look at that list and be distraught at the end of the day. Like, why am I not taking my therapy seriously? Like, why have I not checked off everything? And I'm sure I drove my poor family nuts with that perspective. Because you also, sleep is so important in your recovery. And early on, I slept like a baby. And it's ironically now gone. It's gone different flows of I slept really well, slept all the time. And more recently, I've been in a phase of not sleeping well anytime. And that's kind of phase I'm in that has a big relationship with my headaches, which have been ongoing. Challenge since the accident. I have a great neurologist who is in the DC area, specialized in brain injury, and that's fabulous. But man, the headaches were a doozy, have been a doozy.
So you're still dealing with the headaches?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it goes in flows. It was so much better for quite a while. And it's in a lower phase right now. I don't know why. There are so many different triggers. But there are also the many cognitive triggers of like, challenge yourself, but don't challenge yourself too much. Do social things, but don't do too much social things. Work yourself hard physically. Don't work too hard because it'll give you migraine. So, you know.
Kind of a vicious cycle as you were working your way through.
Yeah. Here's an interesting thing I experienced, I discovered during my rehabilitation was something that is well documented in the brain injury population, and that is called the good old days bias. There's actually a paper, probably based on a study by Iverson et al. It was published in 2010 that addressed this natural human tendency known as the good old days bias. And this paper found that survivors of brain injury often underestimate past difficulties such as memory problems. The survivors estimated that they had little to no memory problems before. When in reality, we know that's probably not true. Every human being has memory slips from time to time. And this discrepancy can impact survivors' perceived levels of deficits and their progress. So I think an application of that as clinicians or as survivors, but speaking from a clinician's perspective, I think it shows the importance of humbly admitting, even pointing out to a survivor when you are having a memory slip, that you've made an error, and best yet, show them how it could have been repaired or prevented with use of a compensatory strategy. So I think learning moments like that are invaluable for speech pathology. Yeah.
No, thank you. That's a really good point to share. Because yes, nobody's perfect. We certainly all have slips of the tongue and difficulty with our memory. So yeah, sharing that, you know, I really like that perspective. The idea that if we share that with our, the people we're working with, our clients or our patients who had a brain injury, so that they, it normalizes all of it, you know, and doesn't make it just the brain injury. It's really pre-brain injury. We all have them. Everybody's got them. And it does, it kind of helps to normalize the whole process a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
What would you say, because you mentioned physical therapy, occupational therapy, neurocognitive therapy, speech therapy, you had a lot of therapies going on. What would you say was the most challenging to you? I know you've mentioned the cognitive was very challenging, but what was the most challenging part of your recovery and therapies and all? Like, what would you say? Like, what was the easiest? And I'm kind of doing air quotes, which no one can see, because I know none of it was really easy. But what was the easiest? I'm still going to kind of use that word. And then what was the most challenging to you in that process?
Okay. Sure. Well, it's an easy answer. The easiest thing, the therapy that I loved, was physical therapy and occupational therapy. I'm a very determined person, so I love the blood, sweat, and tears. You know, that would, if it's effort-based, I would love it. What was worst was the cognitive stuff, the speech therapy. I won't say I hated it. I almost did, but it was hardest for sure.
Was there anything that as a therapist, because as a speech language pathologist myself and someone who's worked with brain injury and now you're practicing, is there anything that you would recommend speech language pathologists consider that might have made it a little easier or might have helped make it not as much of a struggle for you?
Absolutely. There are several things. One, if you can possibly provide a visual depiction of how a client is improving, the progress that they're making, don't assume that they're aware of the progress that's apparent to everyone else. Many times I would have someone well-intentioned say to me, "Oh, you're doing so well. You must be so happy," or, "Wow, look at how you've progressed. That must mean so much to you." And I couldn't remember yesterday, you know, so all I could see was today. And if that was hard, if today was hard, I think so. Advice to give other therapists, I think trying to make progress as visual as you can. So it's apparent. Try to tap into why it is motivating for them. I think it's important for a therapist to recognize the emotional progress or the emotional place of where a client is. Understand the losses that they are facing right now. Loss of language, but loss of life participation activities, the things that they held dearest, were most motivated by, their typical sources of motivation have probably been impacted and are impacted, if not impossible, right now. So understand that sympathetically, if not empathetically.
And I think those are really good points for everyone to be aware of. Did you receive any type of counseling to help deal with kind of the emotional side? You mentioned be aware of the emotional side, but was anyone providing any counseling or guidance for that?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm not the best reporter on this time of life because I don't remember a lot of it, but, you know, I think my gut answer is that it was family members and friends who were present and needing to provide that support earliest on. As I progressed more and I was more aware of how I was doing emotionally, cognitively, then absolutely I have benefited from skilled neuroclinicians. I'm fortunate to be in the DC area, Washington, DC area. So we have many resources available to us. I've seen some fantastic therapists in DC who they specialize in brain injury. And my neurophysiatrist, he is specialized in brain injury. Being in the DC area, I recognize I've had access to fabulous resources. Maybe now in the day of Zoom, people will have more access to high quality specialized care.
I think you bring up a good point in the whole idea of resources, because we certainly know there's areas where the resources just are not in that vicinity. Yeah. But one thing speech language pathologists could do, any profession could do, is to develop a list of resources that are either available in the area or maybe accessible, like you said, via Zoom, if there's a virtual option, or, you know, but to gather those resources and have something available to provide the patient and their family, so then they can access, you know, some of those resources that might help in that whole recovery process.
Absolutely. There's so many fabulous resources, and I keep in my work office and on my home computer, I've got resources ready to go that I can refer any clients, family members to.
And if people aren't aware of where to start, I'll just do one quite quick thing. We do have the Brain Injury Association of America.
Yes.
Yep. Which is a primary national resource that could then direct to more local resources and local, because each state has their own association, and that would be a starting point if someone's not aware of resources.
Absolutely. That is one of my go-tos.
Is it? Yes.
Because they have lists of resources too. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing resource. And not to toot my own horn, I started an Instagram account that is just SLP_TBI. And I don't really know what I'm doing, I'll be honest, but I'm figuring it out as I go along. And I hope it's just a resource for anyone impacted by brain injury to hear my stories, my compensatory strategies, my resources. Yeah.
Oh, I think that's nice that you're sharing that. If there's anything I can ever do to help, let me know.
Happy to help.
But that's nice. I think, and one reason I wanted to do the podcast with you is people always have shared that they learn best when they hear from the patient. Mm-hmm. And you're able to bring, like I said, that dual perspective as both the patient and then as a clinician who's now working in the area. So that's a very unique perspective, I think, that can bring a lot of information that people can then, you know, hopefully use and, you know, put into play, or even if it's not something they directly use, that helps them think about what they're doing a little differently.
Yeah.
You know, and helps. I do want to ask you one question. Someone once shared with me, and you mentioned life participation and the emotional impact of some of the changes that were going on for you. And someone once mentioned to me that to think about my office. And they were saying that they had been in someone's office and they had pictures up of activities they had done, you know, like snow skiing and, you know, just things. And that someone, and it came up that that could be difficult to see when you didn't have that function or skill currently, you know, you're working and you're being held back from maybe what you used to do. And that seeing those types of photos could add to the negative side of that emotional impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if you remember, like, and I'd have to go back and look at my notes from when I first shared at UT. But that's a point I always make in my presentations, is about the physical environment. How, yeah, seeing pictures up in a clinician's office of them going hiking with friends, something that would normally seem, I wouldn't have thought about that before the accident. I very well could have had such a picture in my office. But now I recognize that a client seeing a picture like that can be discouraging, put them in a headspace of feeling like, oh, look at what I can't do. I'm never going to get back to XYZ, which is not what you want. That is not productive for a client to be making progress.
I'll apologize, because more than likely, that's where I heard that story, was at your talk at UT. Mm-hmm. Trying to remember, because I thought to myself, I was like, did Laura tell me this or did someone else? But I bet it was at your talk at UT.
Okay.
And talking about the environment and the photos in the room and how that might, to really think about what you're surrounding your client or patient mm-hmm. with, because of the effect that could have on them mentally, emotionally, just like you said, the headspace that they're in, you know, and the effect that it could have.
Right. I now in my own office, of course, now I'm working from home, but when I'm in my office at hers, I try to just keep it really happy. I have pictures of nature, flowers on the table, fake flowers. And I intentionally have my degrees, my accomplishments that are supposed to be on the wall. I have those intentionally placed behind the client so that they may notice it when they're coming in, leaving, but they're not sitting there staring at, oh, look what my clinician is so proud of. I don't know if I'll ever have the opportunity to earn that degree or something. Yeah, it just gives you a good sympathetic, if not empathetic perspective to think about what is the client sensing from this office, and is that motivating to them in the ways I want to be. Another challenge that is faced by the brain injury community and their caregivers is what is called the hidden disability. As you know of, it means that TBI survivors may often look fine. They don't have a missing limb necessarily, and they may not need an assistive device for mobility or communication, and they may not have any evident scars. That's actually one reason, believe it or not, I'm thankful that that was not my case. It was obvious to everyone that I was very impaired, when I was in a wheelchair initially, and then worked my way up to walking independently without a cane, but that was a process. And I still now, if I'm not intentionally trying to think about how I'm walking, I have a slight limp, and I'm sure the way I carry my head and definitely use my left hand. And I've some scars. I have a scar across my forehead and I have the trach scar. So I'm kind of glad of those physical indicators of that something was, I was needing to compensate for. So usually brain injury survivors, those, you know, most brain injuries are mild TBIs and they may not have any scars or limb differences. But they may not look as good as they may not feel as good as they look. So they may be experiencing headaches, they may be easily overstimulated, or may be experiencing any of the other hidden symptoms common in brain injury. So they're just different viewpoints of survivors, their care partners, and professionals that should be taken into account. I co-authored with my former co-worker, Anna Miller. We co-authored a paper for the ASHA leader. I think it was back, 2015. And that article includes many of the practical applications of my experiences, some of which I've included now, but some additional ones can be looked up there.
That's, what was Anna's last name?
Anna Miller.
Miller. So it's Miller and Morgan?
Yeah, actually those. I think it was her.
She's Morgan and Miller.
But Zolkowski is her new last name. But I think Anna Miller.
Okay. And that was in 2015 in the ASHA leader?
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's another nice resource for people to have.
Yeah.
Everyone may have an interest because, you know, you have your musical background and like you said, the running, are you back to running and?
Always fighting towards it. This year is the 10th year anniversary of the accident. So I really, really, really want to complete a 10-mile race this year. We'll see. But I really want to.
And then what about your music?
Yeah, music. Music was a big grieving process for me because I was I already mentioned having won that competition, open mic. It was a big thing in my life. But then because of the accident, my left hand was affected. So since after, it's a grieving process after working through a couple years of not even wanting to be in the same room as my cello, or I could count on one hand, a couple fingers, how many times I've wanted to sit down with my cello and actually try. It's just too much. It's too important. Better emotionally for me to leave it where it was. But since the accident, I picked up hammer dulcimer, and I hold the hammers in a compensatory manner between my pointer and my middle finger between them rather than normal because my left wrist won't do that action very well. So I've started the hammer dulcimer and I need to practice more, but I like that. I think that's a picture of recovery from brain injury. Some things you you are able to just keep pushing and pushing towards, and you eventually will get somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I hope that is with me in running is an example of that. But there are other things. I was a rock climber back then, and I've tried a couple times since then. And the hemiparesis, the weakness on my left side, I think there's not much of a future in rock climbing for me, but there are other areas where just picking up something new, like hammer dulcimer. I didn't have any background with hammer dulcimer before the accident. So emotionally, it was an easier thing for me to just start from scratch. But that has to be the survivor's decision. As a clinician, especially, you can't force that on them to say, oh, no, here is a great idea. This you will love. Let's do this instead. No, maybe you can tactfully provide options. It has to be their buy-in, their decision.
Well, actually, I think that's a really important point to share also, as far as prior injury skill sets and then post-injury, what someone's able to mm-hmm. either get back to or what they may shift to, depending on their skill sets. You're right. I think it's an individual's decision. It's the client's decision. It's definitely not the therapist. And each person's going to deal with it a little differently. So you do have to take that into account. So thanks for sharing that. I think that's helpful too. And Laura, if you don't mind, can we talk a little bit about the transition? We were talking about your injury and the recovery process. And you mind sharing a little bit about the transition of getting back into speech pathology?
Yeah, sure. Where I was living at the time of the accident and after, it was near Walter Reed Military Medical Center, Naval Military Walter Reed Naval Military Medical. I know it's WRNMMC, I think, Walter Reed National, yeah, whatever, sorry, all those. But I lived close to Walter Reed, and had ties to it since I grew up a military dependent. My dad was a biomedical engineer at NIH, Neurologic Sciences, in the PHS, Public Health Service. So I had ties to Walter Reed, and I started volunteering there as a Red Cross volunteer. I volunteered hundreds of hours at Walter Reed's speech pathology department within the research area. So I just provide assistance in data entry and in clerical assistance, both there and in Walter Reed's, the gym brain. Because the brain gym, yeah, which is also tied, obviously, to the speech pathology department. So I volunteered there. Yeah, sorry, I've gotten off track. What would you like me to?
No, that's okay. You were, I had asked about the transition getting back into speech pathology.
Okay.
Because your accident disrupted your clinical fellow. It occurred halfway through that 9-month period. And so I know you went through a number of extra steps, so to speak, to be able to practice again in the field. So can you share a little bit about the steps you had to go through?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Once I was able to, I started off volunteering in the speech pathology department of Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. And I volunteered at the Stroke Comeback Center, which is in Virginia. Altogether, I think between those two facilities, I volunteered, over 500 hours. So that was a good opportunity for me to refresh my clinical knowledge, the clinical terminology, while also working on my own physical recovery. It was also unfortunate that my praxis scores expired by when I first realized it and looked into it. It had only been 1 month expired, but I took it before the national board and they deliberated for a month and then got back to me saying that I was not given an extension. I had to do it all again. So that meant I had to study for, take and pass the praxis, and start over my clinical fellowship. So the hundreds, if not thousands, of hours that I had already completed were wiped away. So that was rough. I'm grateful that I didn't know from the start everything that I would have to do. I was only making decisions based on the information right in front of me and maybe one step ahead. So I'm grateful for that, that I didn't know.
No, that would have probably seemed like an insurmountable mountain of requirements that you have to do. So yes, finding that out later was probably a really good thing. So you had to take the praxis again. You had to start your clinical fellow over and complete that. Where did you do your clinical fellow?
Yeah, so I was at a point where I had started giving presentations on my experiences and what I was learning that had clinical applications. My first presentation was at the University of Tennessee when I went back to visit my old campus, my old friends that many were still in the area and professors. So I gave a presentation there and then that just started happening. I didn't seek out opportunities. They all just came to me and I was happy to do them. At one presentation I was giving for the Brain Injury Association of Maryland, I was giving a presentation there, and in the question and answer portion of the presentation, someone raised their hand and asked, was I going to finish my clinical fellowship? Was I going to restart and finish my clinical fellowship? And I was like, I don't know. Are you going to give me one? And I found out later that the person who had raised their hand and asked was Tom Krivolsky, who at that time was speech pathologist for the Head Injury Rehabilitation and Referral Services. And he invited me out for a visit and an interview. And I came out, and long story short, I started working there as a cognitive rehabilitation assistant. And then several months later, I transitioned into restarting and finishing my clinical fellowship. And along the way, I obviously had become very interested in brain injury. And I decided to pursue the brain injury certification. So while doing my CF, I decided to take and I passed that certification exam. So I'm now brain injury certified as specialist, and I just find it really fun. All the information is so interesting and really applicable for me now. By the time I was just finishing my fellowship, the other speech pathologists at the facility had to move for different reasons. So then I was the only one left. That's where it's just continued. I've been there for several years now, long enough that I can have a clinical fellow or I can have interns, speech interns, and I've loved that, getting to share knowledge, opportunities, and collaborate with grad students. I love it.
It's quite ironic. I mean, we started out and I said, I stole the phrase from you, kind of the both sides of the table, but you are certainly a great model for someone who overcame very serious injuries and adversities to the point that you could return, and you had to kind of start over. You didn't have to start the graduate program over.
That was the only thing. Yeah.
But at least, you had to take the praxis exam again. You had to start your clinical fellow over again and work your way back through that to now become not only a speech language pathologist, but someone who specializes in brain injury, has the brain injury certification. And you bring such a unique perspective to the care of those patients, because you have both sides of the table, and the insights that you share are beneficial to patients, caregivers, professionals. I mean, it's something that really helps, I think, hopefully everybody treat and look at people with brain injury differently and provide, better care. I mean, that's,
I hope so.
I think you're contributing to that and helping to improve, the care. We only learn so much from research, and we learn a lot more from people like yourself, who've been through it. As a speech language pathologist who specialized in the area of brain injury, I think you've brought great insights. Some of the pieces that you've shared, I sat here thinking to myself, oh, I wish I had known that when I was practicing. So I hope people do take away, I know they will. I won't even say I hope they will. I know that people have some really good takeaways from it. So I really appreciate your time and sharing your story. I know we could go on. I know there's a lot more to your story. So we may have to have you on again at some point for part two to maybe focus in more on, you mentioned compensatory strategies and that being a specialty or a special area of focus for you. And you could get on a soapbox about them, and maybe we'll have your soapbox one day.
Oh, love it.
and focus on compensatory strategies that patients and families and caregivers and professionals can all consider, because that's an area I think we miss. We don't have enough information about, but I do appreciate you sharing your story. Like I said, it's going to contribute a lot to what people are able to provide. I think it's going to be eye-opening, especially the piece about the environment, just considering all aspects of what we provide, not just the treatment, but even our surroundings, just everything that we're bringing to the table when we're working with people. And really, I said, we said earlier brain injury, but really that would be true with any client we have, no matter their initial diagnoses.
Yeah.
If we have to consider our environment. But and anyway, you brought great perspective, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time, and appreciate you sharing your story and your willingness to share.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.